Hello, this is David Brim, and I'm the founder of Orlando Entrepreneurs. We are the hub for Orlando entrepreneurship, and our mission is to connect, cultivate, and celebrate our local entrepreneurs. We bring together our local entrepreneurial ecosystem to help impact our entrepreneurs, their companies, and our local economy. Learn more at OrlandoEntrepreneurs.org. Now over to Josh Wilson to get forward with our show.
Good day, everyone. Welcome to the Orlando Entrepreneur Show. My name is Josh. I travel around Orlando having conversations with other entrepreneurs to hear their story, to share it, to give hope, inspiration, and education to the community here. On today's show, we're having a conversation with Dina Jalbert, who is the CEO and founder of Align Business Advisory Services.
Yeah.
Welcome to the show, Dina.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, this is kind of exciting. So I'm sitting in your office, and it's a very cool office in Winter Park, Florida. And I see all over the walls, like words written everywhere, purpose, growth, innovation, value. Talk to us about who you are, what you do, and what do these words mean for you guys?
Fantastic question. So I founded Align on the mission of kind of breaking the mold of the traditional finance firm. I mean, even just in our space, you kind of called that out. You would traditionally walk into a financial services office, it's dark, you know, dark woods, old school kind of gold, you know, accented things, and it just felt, you know, very stuffy and stodgy. And it's, you know, I'd say you can apply that to a lot of the industries, especially in, you know, investments. And so I wanted to, in founding Align, be completely different than that, kind of be the contrarian, which, you know, most business books would tell you don't always be the contrarian, but for us, that's it's the key to our success. So I spent, you know, 18 years in corporate finance. I came, you know, I'm originally from Chicago and started my career at Arthur Andersen doing consulting and audit and advisory work. And got my first taste for mergers and acquisitions way back then in supporting some of those transactions and doing due diligence and things like that. And I then kind of flip sides of the table, went into private company corporate finance, and then moving here to Orlando, I had opportunity to work for some venture capital and private equity backed companies that we grew and scaled, and I was a part of the team that helped exit those. And I found myself after that point being recruited by these entities to do that over and over again. So I kind of thought to myself, you know, there's a pattern here. So merging that mission with there's clearly demand, you know, now's the time. And so we made the leap and founded Align, and it's been gangbusters ever since. But we're really passionate on helping businesses. So the businesses that we serve are lower middle market businesses, and they're kind of the forgotten set of business. They're not a large enterprise, nor are they a micro or small business. You know, they're growth stage entities. They are ones who, you know, generate anywhere from a, you know, 1 to 2 million a year to 100 million. And these include startups. So I was so glad to talk to you because folks think of startups as kind of a unique standalone entity, but they're a business. You know, they're just a lower middle market business that has all the same challenges. They need capital and growth and, you know, people and resources and strategy and all of these things. And so, so we work to really help that subset of business innovate, grow, find the right partners and the right resources. So, you know, when it comes for our business to really think about, you know, who, what type of investment might they want to achieve? Is a venture capital investor the right type? Or maybe we're mature enough that we could look to private equity or debt, perhaps, maybe we don't. You know, there's so many options. And so all of this that you see, all the words, is we bring an innovative thought into how you put those puzzle pieces together. So we sit down and we say to people, you know, it's one thing to get money and to fund your growth, but you want to make sure it's the right type with the right people. And that's where the innovation and the diversity comes in. You know, we recruit for diversity purposefully, because if you go to the Meet the Team page of most of my competitors, they all look the same and they all kind of come from the same place. And that's great, it works for them. I don't play golf. So we're going to do something a little bit different. And so our network is comes from a myriad of industries and different experience sets. And that's by design, because in putting those puzzle pieces together for a business, you have to have as many minds around the table who have many different experiences who can bring that value to a business owner instead of just looking at their transaction like a commodity. So value, service, diversity, and innovation are our key company values, and I say it over and over and over again. I think our clients get a little tired of it, but.
Sure. So you said if you look at your about page,
yeah,
and then maybe some of your competitors, you don't really fit the mold.
We don't.
Why do you think that that's so important in today's industry?
Yeah, because I think there lacks a level of empathy, and you need to reflect the businesses and the people that you're working with. And in finance, it's very numbers driven. So people make decisions about businesses and what they do based on black and white numbers on a page, and it's very linear. And you know, I'm a CPA originally from trade, so I think I can think that way. But when you are thinking about all the things that make a business work well and why it's valuable, it's more than just the numbers. It's the people. It's the process. It's the technology. It's the marketing. It's the just all of the key drivers and components that make that business successful that generates the numbers on the page. And so I think when you have a diverse team, they capture and see all of those value drivers, whereas it removes the groupthink mentality. So perhaps for others who it's fairly uniform, you know, I think they're all kind of bred from the same playbook. And we want to be different by design. So I don't like the word best practices, because what worked before isn't going to work today in a high growth business. So we try to keep things fresh and come up with new ideas. As an example, we were working with a client, and they are a professional services firm, and we actually introduced them to an ed tech company, educational technology company, and they were like, well, that's kind of an odd. You know, I wouldn't naturally think that's who you would put us in front of, and actually ended up being a really successful acquisition and brought in a whole new line of business. So the buyer found a tremendous amount of value, and the seller was able to maximize the value of their business in a way they hadn't thought before. So that's what we like to do.
So you brought two companies together, mm-hmm. and this is maybe you could give us some definitions of like mergers and acquisitions. Like, talk to us about. Because that might not be on every startup's radar. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe I could merge with another company, or I could be acquired and grow through that. Could you talk to us a little bit about mergers and acquisitions?
Absolutely. So there are many stages of funding for a startup, and the one people most think of is venture capital. It's the capital you get on the front end to kind of get started. But where mergers and acquisitions come in is when you're more mature, when you've taken that venture capital money, you've put it to work, and you've executed it, and now you've gotten to the place where, oh gosh, all these people really like what we're doing. Now we have to serve them all, so we need new things, and we want to grow, and maybe we were successful here locally, but now we want to be a national player, or, you know, whatever the driving need is. And that's where mergers and acquisitions come in. And there's kind of two veins to mergers and acquisitions. Folks always think of mergers and acquisitions means one company is going to buy you outright. Amazon is kind of come in and buy, everyone and everything, right? You keep reading about that. But there's also an element of private equity, or what we call institutional investment. And private equity can take many forms. There's small family offices. They have their own characteristics. And I think that's what a lot of entrepreneurs don't realize, is that there's optionality there. And especially here in Orlando, we don't have a large or robust institutional capital ecosystem, which is one of the reasons, we hope to change that, or at least be part of the narrative. Can't say we're gonna bear that on our shoulders, but we want to be part of that narrative in changing that landscape. But institutional money is really important to scale. And so, and we really love working with entrepreneurs and having them see that, to know like, oh gosh, someone can help us, really expand beyond all that I could even think of in my head. And that's, really what we do. So that's kind of the financial part, or financial investment of mergers and acquisitions. The other part of that is strategic acquisition. So that is where the Amazons of the world, or whomever, one enterprise buys another. And what's key about that is, when a business has grown and has had success and is ready to exit for whatever reason, whether it's a personal reason, you're just ready to move on and do something new, or you want to partner and work as a part of a larger organization and take your what you've built and now grow it even further as a part of a larger organization. And that's, you know, really important and provides a lot of opportunity. You just have to make sure it's like a marriage. You know, you have to make sure it fits well. You like them. I always use the age-old, would you have a beer with them test? You know, even when you're sizing up investors, like, do you like them? Like, would you go out and have a beer with them? Like, do you feel good about the relationship you're going to have?
What's the name of the test?
The have a beer test.
Okay.
Like, would you go out and have a beer with them? Because if it's no, then it's, you know, it's going to be much harder to achieve that growth that everyone, you know, is trying to align, you know, to build together. So I always say people with invested capital or with an offer to acquire you, in either way, you need to do as much due diligence on them as they are on you. And sometimes I think entrepreneurs kind of forget that because they just, you know, they need the capital or they want the next phase. And so sometimes I'll look past some of that, but it's always to the detriment.
Right. And I like what you said about options. So entrepreneurs have the gold, essentially. They have the product. They have something that's innovative. They're hitting the market, serving customers. Mm-hmm. Really, they're the prize. Mm-hmm. And there's different types of capital mm-hmm. out there. Mm-hmm. You mentioned private equity, mm-hmm. family office, mm-hmm. venture capital, mm-hmm. debt. Mm-hmm. How, when a startup is building and growing, how should they know maybe what kind of capital to approach?
Well, and that's the key question. And the reason we focus on this demographic of business is because I think that they don't know that they have options. And so someone like us can really help them understand it and remove some of the emotionality from it too. I mean, I am a business owner and I get it, right? It's your baby. And so when you're talking to someone about, you know, that's why you always read about valuations and people get so up in arms about it and they take it so personally. And it's not a personal affront, it's just market. And so let's root ourselves in data and let's, you know, use that and talk about the value. You know, it's funny, I just today was interacting with some investors and really great business, exceptional business. And the gentleman replied to me, he said, you know, we don't sign NDAs, you know, as in, like, we're too good, you know, for this opportunity. And I'm sure there's a myriad of attorneys who have given them advice and that advice, and that's fine. But the way that reads is we're too good, you know, for, you know, you need us. But as you just said, no, you know, this business, they're the asset, they're the talent, they're going to provide that growth, you know. And so that's where, and that's the story we try to tell. And we're like, okay, well, you know, that's fine, fair enough, yeah, thank you, and on to the next person with a level of interest, because you do have optionality. And but it's hard when you know that cash is only going to last so long, and you know there's a fervor there. So that's, you know, one of a good point where we as a firm really provide that value. So people ask us, are you a banker? Are you a broker? I'm like, no. We're advisors because we want to give that thought leadership, that guidance, that market knowledge that an entrepreneur isn't going to know. Entrepreneurs and the business owners, they know their widget, whether it's a product or a service, you know, whatever it is they do, they know that exceptionally well. They've built an amazing business. And then they need to lean on others who are the experts in other areas, and that's where we come in. And so, you know, to your question, trying to understand the nuances of the different types, it's difficult to do if it's not something you've ever done before. I mean, if this is your life's work, it's all you know, so you wouldn't know the difference between, you know, venture capital and private equity because you've never done it before. And there are very few who have gone through those stages of liquidity in their past lives that they have that kind of institutional knowledge. And so that's, you know, that's where we come in, is to help them understand what it is. And then it's one thing to define it, but then we also help them to say, here's its characteristics. How does that fit into where it is you wanna go? So the first question we ask every client is, when you lay in bed at night and you think about what this investment or acquisition or, you know, whatever is going to generate for you, what do you see? Like, what do you, like, would you get excited about knowing that you've hired us to help you go to market? What is that vision? Because for us, we know that's their motivation and that's what we want to deliver for them. And that's how we then need to benchmark these partners' abilities to deliver that for the founders and the leadership teams.
Yeah. You mentioned these terms, mergers and acquisitions and investments. And maybe can you share for the audience why a company would focus on maybe, like, coming to you and they say, listen, we have some extra capital.
Yeah.
Why should we maybe do an acquisition or a merger versus just invest in this capital in our own innovation? We've got some pretty good developers. Why should we merge, acquire versus invest?
It's a great question. It's that age-old buy or build. And what buying does is it helps you to grow faster. You know, you can buy it and immediately ingest new customers, new talent, new resources, tools, you know, all of the assets that come with a high-performing company and one that really is synergistic and works well with your business. And so you're immediately growing from day one. Whereas that organic investment where you know, take that excess capital and reinvest it back in your business, it will still generate growth for you. It'll just be, you know, it'll take longer. And so it's really when you're thinking about what your overarching strategy is, kind of going back to that motivation question, you know, what are you trying to achieve? You have to ask which one better fits, you know, what you're trying to do. You know, we are in a market right now that is highly competitive. And so a lot of folks are reaching to M&A to get one up on the competition faster than trying to build it themselves. And so we're seeing M&A at record highs. 2018 was the highest level of M&A deal volume and dollar amounts since 2015, and that only 2015 was higher than like 2007 before the last bust. So we're back up to peak levels. 2019 is expected to be the same, and you know, we'll see how 2020 goes. But it's the, and you see the big guys too. So you see Apple, Amazon, they're all acquiring to try to compete with one another. So even if you're a small entrepreneur, you've got some really cool thing, those organizations are going to want to look at you, and or investors who know that those organizations are going to want to look at you will want to fund you.
Yeah. And I mean, you made a really good point, and I think I get it. It's, you can buy or build, that's the age-old question, but if you build it, you're going to go through all the failures that startup already invested in. You're going to have to relearn the whole market. You're going to have to learn so much, and you can catapult yourself forward by acquiring not only the product or the service or the business, but the team, mm-hmm. right? Let's talk about this, because this is a marriage, right? When you acquire or merge, this is a marriage, and an entrepreneur may experience this maybe once in their life. Mm-hmm. You've done this, you're like a marriage counselor. You've done this
quite a few times, yeah.
Quite a few times, right?
Yeah.
So talk to us about that marriage of what happens, what could go right, what could go wrong?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Harvard Business Review has a very infamous statistic in that 70% of all M&As fail. And so you have to ask yourself, well, why is that? And that's because the acquirer, the person doing the buying in this scenario, they focus on just the asset that they want. So say you're a technology firm, just for ease of storytelling. So you've got a key piece of software. They want that software. And so the buyer gets really focused on that, and they want to, so they, when you go through the process, competitive bid, they want to buy this asset. But what they fail to focus on are all the things around it and why that software is so great. Is it, you know, just IP? No, it's the developers and the team and the thought leadership, the product managers, your marketing and distribution to get that software in the hands of people who use it. There's so much more to it. And so in M&A, people tend to just focus on, I want that asset. Sometimes it's not even so much the product or service, it's the, I just want to buy them for the customers. Or I just want to buy them for the geography. Like, they just want kind of one part of it. And those are the ones that fall apart because all the rest of what was good about it gets stripped away. And then it doesn't perform the way they expect. And then the selling entity is like, oh man,
that was their baby.
That was their baby. You know, they just put in their, and they usually end up quitting before their earnout is over and things like that because they're just like, I can't do this anymore. And that's, it's really hard to watch, but it's super common. And that's why we take this innovative, creative, forward-looking view at evaluating deal synergies, because we want all of those pieces to line up. Now, it's like anything, you know, no marriage, good metaphor, is perfect. You gotta work on it. But there are the key kind of core principles, things that make both parties truly in sync. Those are the bedrock that you wanna make sure if those sync up, you can can, you know, the rest can be managed through. And most of the times they only look for those maybe one or two things, and then it goes sideways. So as a entity who's looking to sell, the advice that we give all the time is don't get so wrapped up in the dollars and cents. If you're being acquired, and I, you know, valuation, you watch a lot of Shark Tank or read, you know, in the news, and valuations, when you get really hung up on that, and then let the other things, you know, just go to the side. So for example, you join this new organization, what does that mean for you as the founder? You're now an employee. Are you going to be okay with that? It's a whole different world. And if so, what is your role? What do you get to do? Well, Tom and me, do you have, like, and what's the plan for the combined organization? What are we looking to achieve together? And what is the buying entity? What's their history been in acquisitions? Have they all gone smoothly? Are they performing? You know, asking all of those questions to make sure that you're kind of fully aware of who you're going to be working with is really important. And a lot of sellers don't do that. They just are looking to exit and we'll take the money. And if you're looking to just get out, that's fine. You know, if you don't have no intention of staying on, but there's usually almost always a transition or an earn out. And so you have to be able to make it work. I was once on a team where the entire executive leadership fell apart after an acquisition. And I just felt like I was sitting in a boardroom by myself, like, oh gosh, what happens now? You know, everyone's just kind of throwing their hands in the air saying, you know, no thank you. And the rest of us are trying to figure out what to do here. That was a life lesson that always stuck with me, and I use that often in talking with our clients. On the sell side, similarly, the advice that we give is look at everything. HR is actually the area that is the least looked at in due diligence, but it's the number one on our due diligence list. Who are your people? What do they do? How long have they been there? What's their performance like? You know, what is their background? You want to know all of these things because the human capital is what makes every business work. And in a tight labor market like we have right now, you can't just go out and hire people, especially in really specialized industries. We do a lot of work in legal medical cannabis, and that's not knowledge that you can just walk down the street and find. I mean, you can go into a Starbucks and find a developer these days, but you can't find someone who has like that kind of, you know, institution, an emerging industry. So the people component is really, really important. And so for any buying entity or investing entity, we always tell them, you know, double check that first, make sure that goes along with what you need in the combined organization.
As with any marriage, well, maybe some marriages, kids are brought along, right? And in this case, it could be employees. So it's not just making a decision for the leadership. It's the 10, 20, hundreds of employees that are now being married in this with you. Mm-hmm. How could the employees help make the mindset of the founder, CEO, help them make that decision?
Yeah, it's culture. You know, that's a lofty word, and it's hard to evaluate culture. But having your team and just giving their opinion of what their perception is of an entity. The issue is that there's so much confidentiality that goes on. You have to maneuver around it a little bit. You can't ask everyone in the company, hey, what do you think about ABC and Co? But if you've got a key team, bring those key people into the fold. Bring them in early. There's always a hesitation of folks to be like, oh, if I do that, they're going to quit. Well, we help them ideate on ways to make sure that that doesn't happen. There are many things that you can do as you're, you know, long before you've sold a business to make sure that they would actually much more appreciate being a part of the process than being surprised by it. So, and so bring those key people in and ask them the questions, tell them, you know, give them the knowledge that you have and see what their reactions, you know, are to that. And if you involve them in the process. So one of the things that we always do is a management meeting, and it's usually just the founder, CEO, maybe, you know, the co-founder if there's, you know, two or three of them, but and then the investors, and like no one else gets to be involved. And I always say involve your key right people and have them be part of the process so that they can evaluate and hear things. I always joke that when I go to the doctor, my husband will tell you I'm the worst patient. I don't listen. He's telling me things about myself, and I don't hear. it's no different for a founder when you're it's a very intimidating place to be. And so investors are talking to you and they're asking you questions and you're just getting through that and you're probably filtering out a lot of things. So have other people in the, we're there, but have your key team members a part of the process so they can hear things that you're missing, pick up on things that you don't see, and help you really make the right decision, because you can always say no. I mean, we've had deals a week before, the founder's like, you know what? No, now's not the time. And that's much better to do that. Yeah, you gotta pay some attorney's fees, but you know, it's better than getting married and regretting it a year later, so.
There's options.
There are options. And that's the key thing, is you have choice. You're the asset. You're the one who's built something amazing. You're the one with the vision. And they're looking for new innovation. They're looking for growth. They're looking for you to be a part of that. So even financial investors, so 65% of all private equity employ a strategy called buy and build. So what they do is they buy one kind of larger company, and then they buy smaller ones, bolt it on, create an infrastructure around it, and sell it. It's very common. And it's actually becoming more and more common for them because you're getting much larger returns on it. And all those same things that we're talking about still apply in that model. When you're buying those add-ons, how do they fit in? You know, you have to make it cohesive, and how all those things operate, you know, really matters. So even if you're just taking in investment, all those same questions apply.
Yeah. And when you and I had a conversation, I think it was a week ago or a few mm-hmm. days ago, you said when a deal goes bad, a lot of money is left on the table, and it hurts both sides of the coin.
It does. So value is, it's in yellow there and in bold up front, is a key service driver for us. And if you were to ask what makes us different than any other banker or intermediary in the country, I would say it's value, because we want to make sure there's value on both sides of the table. So the reason we focus on this demographic of business is because they didn't realize they had an advisor or someone who could help them. So investment banks traditionally don't go this low. They usually stop at the 50 million threshold. And so that leaves, you know, startups without a lot of guidance. And the ones that do, you know, don't really give them a whole lot of attention. It's usually a junior associate who's, you know, 2 years out of college and very bright individual, I'm certain, but it's never run a business. And it's just very, you know, the motivations, kind of back to the motivation I talked about before, they're just not in sync. And so the value we provide to sellers is giving them that thought leadership, service and attention that they're not getting from other advisors. You can have an excellent attorney, you can have an excellent CPA. They're both very good in their spheres of influence, but not when you're talking about strategic human capital and growth plans and strategy and scale. They're very good in their widgets, but they're not going to give you that type of thought and planning, and that's what we do. So that's the value we create, and then it helps them understand what they're worth. And worth as in, yes, in valuation terms, but worth as in, you know, I want to stay on for 2 years. I want an equity package of X. Like, it's also what the larger package and forward-looking thought is. Where we create value on the side, and let me back up before I move ahead. The sellers prior to engaging us didn't know that they had choices, that they can negotiate packages like that. We had one client who didn't understand there's a thing called a working capital lever. That's for another day and a more boring show than this one. But anywho, he didn't know what it was, and his attorney wasn't explaining it to him, and he could have left almost $1.5 million on the table. It was 10% of his entire purchase. And so once we were able to explain what it was and tell him how he could fix that so that it didn't become an issue, and how we could structure terms so that it didn't burn him, he was like, oh gosh, I'm so glad. So that demographic of business is so underserved, and that's why we're here. But conversely, on the other side of the table, if you're an acquirer or an investor, traditionally, if you hear that there's a broker, or banker, or an intermediary, they roll their eyes like, oh great, I gotta jump around this guy to get to this business. I'm just not. you know, they didn't view it as a positive thing. And so that's a narrative I want to change as well. So when we bring deals to investors, we bring thoroughly vetted deals, good solid businesses. And if there are issues, we highlight them, because I never view issues as a bad thing. They're actually opportunities, because they might be issues for the business as it's running right now in its current smaller, unscaled place. But you put it with a larger organization, or it's funded with institutional money, well, then you can solve those problems, and then you can make it, you know, good and great. And if they could solve all those problems on their own, well, why do they need you, right? And so a lot of founders tend to think, oh, I can't tell them that, you know, we don't have this, or my back office is kind of messy, and this, we can work through that. The solution is that. And so where we bring value to the investment community is that when there are issues like that, we either help fix it or make it known, so it's not something that's found later that creates a perception of there being something wrong when there isn't. And so when we bring these really vetted opportunities to investors, they love it. They're like, oh, this is so great, because I know what it is. We can, you know, get down to it faster. I can get it into my business or portfolio faster. It's going to accrete a return on investment faster, because we either the investment has been made, or we know exactly what needs to be done post-close to really get this thing humming. And so it's created a lot of value. We have, just in the last 6 months, significantly grown our investor network. They now reach out to us, fly down to talk to us, see us as a partner, and not just a, hey, you know, let me know if you've got something, because they know that we don't commoditize transactions. And so we're now on their radar, which is fantastic.
It's good when money's coming to you, when investors are coming to you. Now, you said investors are flying down to you. Are there none here in Orlando, or what's your thoughts on the growing market here in Orlando?
There are some
for investors.
Yeah, there are some here, and especially for like the true early stage, like seed and angel stage. We've got some groups here locally, I think, that have done a really good job, and I think have shown by example that it can be done. And I think as you see a shift of that baby boomer generation come out of full time work and into their, you know, they like to play golf, but they also want to do things.
Let me get back in the game.
Yeah, you're going to see them putting their money to work, you know, and so I think you're going to see more of that. I think that's great. I think where we struggle locally is that institutional money for the lower middle market, your $5 million to $10 million investors. You know, there's some great groups in Tampa, there's some great ones in Miami, but locally here in Orlando, they're not is prevalent. And I think that's hopefully with some more success stories of, you know, some of the businesses that we have locally that are churning and growing and are, I think, going to have nice big deals and exits. I think they're going to see that this is really a market that they should pay attention to, and hopefully some will spin up or expand and put a local presence here. I think you'll see some of the kind of Southeastern, maybe the Atlantas and Charlottes of the world, where there are some good middle market PE firms, they might put an office down here, but they want to see, you know, that's an easy flight versus standing up a presence. So it's, you know, it, but if we have enough, I think, wins to show, then I think, you know, the money will follow. And one of the things that we're doing as the person who sits in the middle is we highlight and, you know, show people there are great businesses here. You know, I mean, this quarter we're going to have 30 million, hopefully 30 million of local businesses here, either be acquired or achieve funding, you know, by March 30th. And so those are the things we like to then show to investors, see, look, there's innovation here, there's good ideas, there's good businesses, there's great academics. So, you know, when you talk about the talent shortage, being able to grow your own thought leadership is and talent pools is really meaningful. So we kind of like to think of ourselves as someone who shines the light on the market. We're trying to do it more and more.
Yeah. Now, you guys are breaking the mold in how traditional financial institutions are run. You mentioned the cannabis industry. Give us some examples of what's currently going on in the market and why people should pay attention to potential acquisitions and mergers, even if they're not in that industry itself.
Yeah, so consolidation is rampant, you know, in every industry, but the one in particular, so you mentioned cannabis, I'll kind of start there, is, you know, that's a brand new industry, really. I mean, it's only been, you know, truly legally going from a business perspective for about 3 to 4 years. So even if you started right then, your business isn't that mature. And the constraints we have domestically for capital and all what you can and can't invest in and has really kind of put a tight noose around the neck of some entrepreneurs and founders in that space. So what you're seeing is you're seeing a lot of M&A happen. Because these, and it's super fragmented, the industry is so fragmented because it's all these smaller, you know, lower middle market businesses. And so you're seeing all this M&A happen. I read every day about a deal that's happening in that space. And it's the larger organizations from either Canada or those who've made early grabs at market share domestically, making acquisitions because back to that buyer build, it's easier for them to buy it. And then what happens is as more states open up their regulations, they're immediately poised to jump in and grab that market share. And the sophistication of business owner is changing there too. You're seeing a lot of entrepreneurs who came from other industries are now getting in here and they're bringing their business knowledge and that a knowledge of how to grow and scale a business into this industry. And so prior to that, I think there were just small business owners who, you know, kind of got to where they are and, you know, had a good business where they were, but, you know, beyond that, it's they're a little over their skis, and so that's where M&A, I think, is going to continue. I mean, it was up 500% in just 1 year from 17 to 18 in just this industry, and I think that's going to just continue, and especially if some more of the businesses can trade on the stock exchanges here, the more capital they have, the more they're going to go out and acquire businesses to grab that market share. So that's an industry that we really love working in, and, you know, it really lines up well with our kind of contrarian model. It's not one that a lot of people want to get into. They still immediately think of, like, you know, high school and the, you know, the head shop and, you know, guy with dreads or whatever. You know, their mind goes to a place which it's completely not the case. I just spoke at MJ BizCon, which is one of the big trade shows, where 27,000 people. I met with a ton of investors. You're seeing now blue chip companies want to come in, and so it's starting to be more mainstream, but not a lot of finance presence there, because I think I call the navy blue button with, or navy blue blazers with the gold buttons is how I refer to
the
Right. The old school guard of finance. They're more risk averse. That's just not in their tolerance. Now, there are some great groups that we work with who definitely don't fit that mold. But, you know, you go there and there are very few in finance. So we like that. Another area that we are really focused in on, and I think you're going to see so much more of it in 2019, is women-owned businesses. Founders and CEOs of women-owned businesses. There are now funds and firms spinning up to invest solely in those types of organizations. There's actually one in cannabis that we're talking to right now who wants to invest in women-owned founders and CEOs, which I just think is amazing. And so I think there's going to be more of that. And, you know, one of the kind of three main reasons I founded the firm is because it was really hard for me as a woman in finance. You know, you weren't understood a lot. I was often thought of as maybe aggressive, but I'm just trying to, you know, keep up with everyone else. And I have a bit of a soft spot for that struggle. And so I think so does, though, now the larger marketplace, because there's an awareness. There's a dialogue happening that hasn't happened before. And so, and women supporting women, we're actually just kind of taught to not do that, because, you know, when you're fighting for seats at a table, it's kind of like when you're a kid playing duck, duck, goose, right? There's only one place to sit down and there's five of you. You know, the A-type people, we tend to get really competitive. And so now I think we're seeing that, well, gosh, we don't need to do that. We're stronger if we support each other. Then, so as we go into 2019, area of focus for us, and because we see it in the larger marketplaces, is on women-owned businesses and women founders.
Do you think, in comparison, so I'm a guy, right? In comparison, guy versus maybe a female going for funding, do you see a difference or discrepancy in funding opportunities or business growth opportunities like that?
Absolutely. Because it's all about, when you go in to pitch to an investor or to an acquirer, you have to make them understand your business and why it's valuable. If the people around the table don't reflect you, right? And this is why we reflect our clients, because you have to understand their why. So when you go into a room and it's all the same faces and they don't reflect you, they don't understand. So for example, we worked with a client who they produced a female care product and for new mothers, and they had to go pitch to a room full of men. Well, there's not a person in that room who can empathize or understand.
Yeah, I have two kids and I have no clue what all that
exactly
is.
Right. And so it's not, but there wasn't one woman in the room to be like, yes, that's exactly
what we need. This.
We need this. Oh, if I would have that, when it's hard to pitch and just have them see to truly understand the value around the business. We can show them the numbers. So then what we do is, okay, let's root in data. Let's put some visuals. Let's get some, testimonials. Let's get some things that can help them say, well, maybe I don't understand it, but it seems like a good opportunity. Whereas if the man walked in, they'd be like, oh, well, that sounds great. Let's
send their wife, like, what is this thing?
Exactly. So it is harder because there's just it is that women are, men are from Mars, women are from Venus. Sometimes there is just that block. And that's where I think, though, with the changes we're seeing on a societal scale and men becoming more aware, it's starting to break down a bit, but it does still exist. I mean, I'm not saying it's easy, but when you're a woman and you walk into a room, it's really hard. And they also, I've been there. They look at you like you're their daughter or granddaughter or, whatever. And I have one guy who just kind of tilts his head at me like, oh, you're cute.
You're precious, right?
Aren't you sweet? And then I'm aggressive, right? And that's the tough part is that duality of kind of societal perception. So you walk into a room, and if you're confident and you own it and you know your stuff, some might perceive you a certain way. And what we coach people is, you shouldn't care. At this day and age, don't care. Don't change your narrative. Don't change the way you talk to people, because otherwise you're shoving a square peg in a round hole. So back to that fit. So maybe you translate things and concede some things for that audience, but then you're gonna have to do it forever, and they're not gonna be your biggest cheerleaders and looking to support you. So we have to go find those who will, and that's why these funds who've spun up now focus on women and social. Mm-hmm. I love you'll probably remember the name, but locally, a fund and an accelerator focused on companies with a social purpose. I think you're
going to see. Rally.
Thank you. Yeah. Yes. And it's a shame I have friends who work there. Sorry, guys. I think you're going to see more and more of that. So I think, the days of it being so hard the edges are softening a tad. It's still tough, but it for every woman founder, and also it's tough for women being in the profession of finance. One of the things we do here is we provide 12 weeks paid family leave, because I remember being a new mom and really scared about what that meant, not financially, but also career-wise. Like, well, if I'm absent, what am I going to miss?
And fill my spot or find someone else.
Yeah, and oh gosh, that project's going to be happening. I was doing an M&A deal, and I was scared to tell my CEO that I was supporting that I was pregnant until we closed it. We're at the closing party and champagne, and I'm like, Dan, I'm like, nope, now's the time to tell you. And I shouldn't have to do that. So one of the things in founding my firm is also I want to just be the different type of finance firm who's family friendly. Like, I'm in a sweatshirt because I was just at my kid's art class helping her volunteer. or I was volunteering to help them, and I want women who want to come up in finance and do this feel like they have a place that they can, and hopefully other, you know, other firms will start to take shape.
Can I ask you a favor? Mm-hmm. So I have a 5-year-old daughter. She's super smart. She's definitely going to be my boss one day. Let's say she wants to go into finance. Mm-hmm. Right now she's doing her math and she's asking me questions that I don't know. So let's say she wants to work for you in 20 years.
Sure.
What advice do you have for my future daughter?
Ask for and accept help. So we can be super knowledgeable, and for those who, and I fit in this mold, because like I said, I'm a CPA by trade, so numbers come easy, and you know, I'm good at trivia, and just certain that side of my brain fires, those synapses fire harder. So you know, technically smart, but where when I look back, where I wish I would have done things a little different is I wouldn't accept help when offered, because I would view it as a sign of weakness. Like, oh, I should know this. You know, I should just do it. I can do it myself. There's that could versus should. And so at any stage in your career, no question is stupid or a reflection of anything. If you ask, you can improve yourself faster if you ask and accept for help. So, but it's something that I still have to do in my 40s. So, and always know your worth, and don't ever hesitate to ask for it. So, you know, when you're switching jobs and you're not sure if you should negotiate salary, you should. If you have that value, you know, if you've got the skill set and the expertise, and much like we coach our clients when you're at the negotiating table, always know your value and don't be afraid to fight for it. Because sometimes I would. There were a couple of instances where I was like, oh, well, that's okay.
I'll eat it.
I'll wait. They'll give it to me in a couple years when they see how great I am. You know, there's one job, they're like, well, we think you could be good at this, but, you know, we're only going to start you here, and then maybe. And I was like, okay, that's fine. And I should have been like, no, I can do that now. And, you know, it worked out in the end, but, you know, older me is telling younger me you shouldn't have settled and should have just gone for it. So
You have not, because you asked not, right?
Exactly right.
Yeah. Now, I looked up on the wall, and one of the biggest words on your wall is community, mm-hmm. right? All these words are incredible. Like, what is community to you, and like, how are you involved in the community?
Yeah, so I grew up in a small farm town just out west of Chicago, and so everyone knew everyone, and it was very communal. And then then I moved to Chicago proper, lived there for a number of years, and that even still has a big city, but a communal feel to it. We lived in South Florida, did not have a communal feel to it, because everyone's from everywhere else. But as I've gotten older and I've had children, you want your community to reflect and provide the things that you want, you know, for others and for your family. So I worked for a number of organizations where doing philanthropy was like a chore. And these are big businesses making a bunch of money and we were talking little things. And I just never quite understood why that was, I mean, to the detriment. Like there was one company I worked with that, it was a big deal because I wanted to sponsor something. But, you know, all your employees live here locally. You should give back to the community that the people that work for you live in and make the world a better place if you can. When I had my girls, I had a really rare heart condition called peripartum cardiomyopathy. And so at the age of 31, I was in intensive care and heart failure. I'm like, what is this?
What's going on?
And then they're like, no more kids. I'm like, wait, what? And so it was crazy. And I thought to myself, I'm like, well, there needs to be more resources around cardiology for women. Because again, talking back, you think about cardiovascular health, you think of men, you know, the traditional movie scene where the guy falls to the floor, right? But actually, it's the number one killer of women. And I didn't know that until I was in ICU at the age of 31, going, huh. And so my type A personality was, what can I do? How can I? And so 6 weeks after I had my youngest, I was sitting across the table from a development officer at Florida Hospital, Florida Hospitals Foundation, saying, what can I do?
What's a development officer?
She's the person who helps raise money for the foundation. and is the liaison to the hospital. So she actually works with the physicians to say, what do you need? What do you want? What ideas do you have that, you know, the traditional means can't fund? And then she works with the board, which I then eventually went to sit on, and we go out into the community to raise money for those. So, you know, innovative technologies and solutions. One thing we did, and it sounds so simplistic, you know, that tape that athletes wear on their arms?
KT tape.
KT tape, yeah. So this is actually, this one was called K-tape. But when you have open heart surgery, they essentially cut your chest open, right? And the only thing that post-op you have is a little heart pillow. And so when you cough, and when you have to lean into just a pillow, like, whoa, revolutionary, right? For weeks, and it's super painful. And so this tape, they actually, we actually helped fund a study where you can put that tape, and it helps healing times, it helps it heal faster. It reduces the dependency on pain medication and, you know, the opioid addiction that we have. And, you know, no one wants to be on those as long as you have to, and recovery rates increased. And I mean, that's a really small example, but then just my last year on the board, we raised over $1 million to fund an entire new pulmonary and cardiac intensive care unit at the hospital. So we went from K-tape to an entire new ward where they now save, you know, thousands more lives every year. And I love giving back to the community, because I think about having that resource in our backyard is so much more meaningful than having to, you know, fly to Mayo Clinic or, you know, Cleveland Clinic or, you know, go to Chan's. And those are all great institutions, but to know that you have that in your backyard improves your community, improves the care and the place that you live. My family and I were also very faith focused, and so I want my kids to be of service to others. And the only way that you can do that is by modeling that same example. So we give a lot of money to philanthropy, even as a startup in this business when we weren't making really any money at the beginning, still gave what we had. I'm just also a believer that the more positivity you put out into the world, it comes back to you. And in your local community, it's just all the more important, because the people who come to work with you and for you every day, you want them to have that same positivity and want to, you know, do the same in their sphere of influence. So.
You know what I think is really great is that you took your skill set in advising companies to get funding, right? So you're working with companies, you're their advisor, their trusted advisor, breaking the mold of that, showing them their different options, helping them explore how to grow through maybe merger acquisition and funding. You took that and you applied it to something that, you know, essentially saved your life, and you helped them raise millions of dollars, taking that one talent and bringing that over, or many talents and bringing it over.
Yeah.
Do you think there should be such a far divide between the work you do and the things that you give?
No, absolutely not. And that's why it's such a pillar for us, is because what you do and how you give and how you, everyone has their own unique talents. You just said it, right? So I used my skill set to help that organization. And so whatever your skill set is, whether it's artistic, you know, we were just kind of joking earlier, I don't have an artistic bone in my body, but perhaps you do, right? And so to help the Museum of Art with a new collection or a new children's program, or I don't know, you know, whatever your unique talents are, kind of the faith-based thing for me is, you know, we're all beautifully and wonderfully made, and we're all unique in what we can give. And so why shouldn't that, your personal and professional gifts merge? So one of the things you hear all the time, people talk about work-life balance. Well, I think it's just life balance, you know, and each day it's different. You know, some days it's all one thing, and some days it's, you know, I always say, like, one beginning of the year is always a busy time of year for us, so maybe not as, I did volunteer today, but I maybe not be as present at, you know, kid events this month, but I make up for it later, or, you know, we have a focus on philanthropy, so maybe we you know, step away from some other professional obligations so that we can do that instead. It's all kind of a give and take, but I feel like all of those things come from the same melting pot of, you know, passion and purpose and drive and talent and the things that you enjoy doing. You know, because if we're all here, we're all not here just to wake up and make the donuts and go to sleep and then, you know, die. That's really morbid, but I view it as, you know, what you can put out into the world to make it better while you're here and enjoy it, you should. So we make it a key cornerstone of the business, that community is part of who we are and always will be. Always will be.
That's awesome. Why did you choose Orlando? From Chicago, South Florida, why Orlando?
So my husband grew up here. So he grew up in Winter Park. And so we moved up here to be closer to family when we were starting our family. I actually moved the week after we got married. It's when we came home from the honeymoon. The movers came 2 days later. Yeah, but we like to do things in threes, like all, let's get new jobs and move and get married all in like a 30-day
period. The three most stressful things, right?
Yeah, and then, you know, fast forward a few years later, I was pregnant, sold the company, and then tore the roof off my house and rebuilt the second story all in the same 60-day one. I mean, it's a weird thing that we seem to do, but he grew up here, and we just liked the community feel. I mean, I love Chicago, but it is cold.
It's cold.
So I can't live there, but visit every year. I have lots of friends and family who still live up there, but what we liked about Orlando Wind Park, just in raising a family, is it has that community. But then I also, as far as the business, so when I left my last organization, thought about starting my business and got a lot of offers to go to other markets. And, you know, for us, this was home. So I'm like, no, this is something we can do here because there's a great ecosystem. You know, the benefit of Disney World as a resident is that you can get on an airplane and get a shuttle to anywhere, you know, anytime. And so it's easy for us in a service business to get, you know, and we have a lot of West Coast clients. And, you know, that cross-country flight, while long, you know, there's a shuttle three times a day and we can get to anywhere. And so it's super convenient. But, you know, we are a big bit, we're a national business, but our office isn't that big. You know, we're also a virtual workforce, so we give folks the ability to work at home and have lives and all of those things. And so for me, when it came time to starting the business, I knew I wanted to do it here. Folks even said, don't you want to be downtown? I said, yeah, I said, but my kid's school is 5 minutes away, so it's easier just to, you know, keep it here. And we found a great space. But I think kind of we were talking earlier about wanting to shine the light on the cool things that can happen in Orlando. I knew we didn't have to give up Orlando to go be successful in doing this. It's, you know, we have a lot of out-of-area clients. But in interacting with investors, we're still shining the light on Orlando. You know, every call I have, like, oh, you're based in Orlando? Yeah. Oh, you're working with a guy in LA? Yeah. You know, and this investor's in New York. And so every interaction we have, I think, hopefully, shines the light on there's opportunity here. And it's a beautiful, bright, sunny day. And most days of the year, so that's not bad either.
Yeah, we're in January, and there's no snow on the ground like in Chicago.
Yeah. I couldn't ever do it again, I don't think. I don't know, never say never, but yeah, I don't miss those winters.
What's a huge goal that you have? You mentioned, like, when you're talking to founders, that they're up in bed and they're thinking and they're dreaming. What's a huge goal or a huge dream that you have?
Oh gosh, that's a great question. You know, really finding my purpose. I would say that I struggled with that for probably the last 5 to 6 years prior to founding the firm. I was just kind of lost in what my next step really needed to be, and I was second guessing myself too much, not fighting for my value. And so my biggest goal really is creating something that allows me to truly, like you were pointing out earlier, kind of use my talents in all those different ways. You know, I want to be a good mom. I want to be present for my kids. I went to an investor conference, not a conference, it was a PE firm's annual meeting, and it was a dog and pony show. We sat in a room and reviewed PowerPoints, which you could just have emailed that out to everyone and reported that same news, but they all wanted to play golf with one another, so that's why we were there. And I missed my kid being the flag holder, my little pre-K, she was four at the time. Just turned four, holding the flag at school, and I missed that day. And I was like, I have a choice here, you know. And so, for me, it was my biggest goal is finding my purpose, and I feel like I've found it here in what we're doing. So I just want to continue to grow that, and I want to support other women and show that they can find their purpose too.
Very cool. What question should I have asked you that I didn't ask you?
Oh, gosh. You know, what are, you know, I've talked a lot about the good things that come from M&A. There's a whole kind of really complex and hard process that's not so pretty sometimes that maybe we didn't touch on as much. I mean, there's an average deal, whether it's an investment or an acquisition, takes almost 1,000 hours of time. And that's a real drain on resources. And then when you're a founder, your business has to perform when you're in that window because you're under so much scrutiny. So if you take your eye off the ball, even just for a minute, things can go sideways and that can just totally change the deal. We've seen that happen many a times. And so, we have a lot of war stories on what not to do. But that's the beauty of what we do, though, is we can impart those as data points to say, you know, hey, we've seen this. You know, it's not just anecdotal. You know, we've seen this happen. So, you know, let's. But the difference is we don't. We help them solution things so that, you know, to try to mitigate those issues. Whereas I think, and that's why we do things differently than most. You know, you work with many others, and they don't care. It's just really, you know, we're on the clock to get your deal done, and we'd like to get this commission in by the end of the quarter. And it's far more of a commodity. Whereas, you know, we'll take as long as it takes to make sure it gets done the right way. And but with it comes a lot of, you know, things don't go smoothly all the time. And so, I would say maybe that's it. But no, I think we've covered quite a bit.
Sounds good. So if there's groups out there, they're either investors looking for pre-vetted deals, mm-hmm. they're entrepreneurs who are thinking of maybe positioning themselves for an acquisition or for a merger, or a larger organization that says, we need an M&A strategy to help us grow. Mm-hmm. Should we buy or build? Mm-hmm. How can people find you?
Yeah, so we are on every social media outlet. You can come to our website. So our website is alignba.com, so business advisors. So alignba.com. You can email us through there. We're on LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You can get to us through any of those channels. Come on by the office. We're here in Winter Park in between Wymore and Lee Road. In between Fairbanks and Lee Road on Wymore. And we speak quite a bit at many industry events. So if you're at any of those, keep an eye out for us. We're at most.
Sounds good. What we'll do is we'll add those links and that information in the show notes. So if someone wants to get to know you, reach out to you, develop an M&A strategy, or just kind of hear some of those horror stories so maybe that they can not leave millions and millions of dollars on the table.
Yeah.
We'll do that in the links.
Yeah, absolutely. Great. And I would say we are always open to have a coffee and talk. You know, we also are not a firm who needs a retainer to have a conversation or charge you for an hour. If you have a question about anything, even if you have something that's already in progress and don't need us, but just would love someone to call, we're happy to, you know, sit down and have a coffee and have that conversation, or drink, depending on what you prefer.
Depending on what time of the day it is, right?
Exactly.
Coffee
or how stressful it, yeah. You know, how stressful it might be. But no, truly, if for those who I was inspired when you talked about at the beginning, you know, educating and providing information to folks, we love to do the same. So if anyone that's listening has any questions, don't hesitate to ever reach out.
Cool. So you guys heard that, ladies and gentlemen in the audience. This has been another Orlando Entrepreneurs podcast show interviewing entrepreneurs in and around town here. I encourage you guys, if you fit those molds, who are looking for someone who is different, someone who is breaking the mold of the current funding strategies in the M&A world, to get some advice or some strategies, I encourage you to reach out to Dina and her team. We'll include those links in the show notes below, but thank you guys for listening into this show and for being a part of our entrepreneurial community here and for lifting up and working together to do so. Dina, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate you.
Thank you so much. It's a lot of fun.
Awesome. Guys, you have a wonderful day, and we will talk with you all on the next episode. Goodbye, everyone.
Thank you for listening in on today's episode. If you would like to be a guest on the show or start up a conversation with me, Josh, your host, send me an email to josh@orlandoentrepreneurs.org. You can also find out more information on Orlando's entrepreneurial ecosystem, discover resources to help you start and grow your business, and subscribe to future shows by visiting
www.orlandoentrepreneurs.org.